This is Mental Selling. This is the sales podcast for people that are dedicated to making a difference in customers' lives and have a purpose beyond just a paycheck. I'm your host, Will Milano. Let's get right into the show. The road to success in sales is paved with purpose and passion. And the energy and passion that salespeople exude is felt by your customers, leading to very measurable sales results and career satisfaction. That's our focus today on Mental Selling, your favorite sales podcast. Elena Love is a well-known keynote speaker, consultant, and thought leader. She is the author of the book, The Purpose-Linked Organization, and Elena is CEO of the firm Purpose-Linked Consulting. She's also been a member of Marshall Goldsmith's 100 Coaches, and Elena joins me today. Thanks so much for being with us today, Elena.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Previously, you were executive director of HR for Merck. Is that right?
That's correct. I was. I'm a recovering HR professional, I like to call myself.
So I've been very excited to speak with you for a long time. I'm so glad to have you on the show with us today. To start with, let's talk about how we all tend to understand at a surface level how purpose and passion can help us navigate our lives and careers and just be happier people and more content humans. But we can have a hard time being introspective enough to actually evaluate and work on those things. So to begin with, why is it important to find out what you're passionate about and to what degree your work inspires and drives you?
Oh boy, that's a huge question. And it's one that I really struggled with for many years to understand I needed to ask myself and then understand what the answer might be. I think what's most important to recognize is if you do a little back of the envelope calculation and you work a normal work week and you take all of your time off and you take all of your vacation, et cetera, which nobody I know is doing, we will spend roughly 85,000 hours of our lives at work. Unless we hit the lottery, that's pretty much what our lives are going to be. That is a very long time to spend doing anything that you don't love. And I came face to face with that dilemma in my own career when I was an executive director of HR and making this decision about, do I want to continue down this path? Do I want to do something different? And I remember having the feeling that what I was doing there, I was very good at and successful at doing, but somehow it wasn't connected to a deeper purpose that I thought I was here to achieve. Yet, if you asked me what that purpose was, gun to my head, I couldn't answer the question. I really didn't know. And that sort of set me out on a 7-year quest to really understand that question and understand how to help people find that answer. And what I discovered is that when you have that clarity around your purpose and your passions, who you are and how you want to show up in the world, it touches every aspect of your life. It makes you better at everything you do, better at relationships, better at the job you're doing, better at the interactions you have with colleagues and clients. It just makes life a lot more fun, a lot easier. So I think it's a question worth examining for yourself, and it's an answer worth pursuing. And one piece of advice I would give to people around pursuing that answer is to have patience with themselves, to recognize that this isn't an add water and stir kind of process. It requires some deep thought and introspection. And the product of that introspection builds over time. It's not as if you decide, oh, today I'm going to go sit cross-legged on a mountaintop somewhere and the answers are going to find themselves to me and I'll know just what I need to do and who I am and all of those things. This is something that you evolve into over time. So having patience with yourself to discover those answers is really an important first step.
And it's not a box you check, right? It's not something like you do when you're 25 or 30 and you're done with for the rest of your life.
No, it's not. But what's really cool about it, Will, is that when you do figure that answer out for yourself, you start to recognize that your purpose, your passions are things that you will manifest throughout your lifetime in myriad ways. There's not this one thing you have to do. And once you've accomplished it, you're all finished. I can sit on the porch and rock in my rocking chair and the kids are grown. All the pets are gone that I had to take care of. And it's just me hanging out here waiting for whatever the end will bring me. You're constantly in some iteration of expression of that purpose, expression of that passion, which is for me a fulfilling thought because it means that we're never really finished. We're constantly evolving. We're constantly learning. We're constantly growing as people, which allows us to be our best selves in all aspects of the life we live.
Yeah, you're constantly growing as a person and in your career. So in the context of sales, which I know you've got a lot of experience working with sales organizations, how does purpose and passion impact them? Why is it important for salespeople, and how does it impact things like employee engagement and the degree that salespeople will apply added or discretionary effort, their job satisfaction, those sorts of things?
Well, you know, there's a really interesting recollection that I have about talking about what it takes to sell well. And it was a conversation that I had with a guy by the name of Jerry Keller. Jerry Keller used to head sales for Merck. And he was a very gregarious, outgoing guy everybody loved. And he could always tell a story, which was a wonderful gift that he had that engaged people. And he and I were having this conversation one day, and we were in agreement that people buy from people that they like and that they trust. And in order to be that person that's likable and trustworthy, you have to figure out who the you is that the person is supposed to like and the person is supposed to trust. Absent that, you don't show up as your most authentic self, and the other person is feeling like, what am I really getting here? Do I really understand this person, know this person, et cetera? So some of the key to that is understanding yourself from a perspective of purpose, understanding what your passions are, and understanding how when you show up as your whole self, being completely who you are and unapologetic about it, how are other people receiving you? And I think authenticity sells. So much selling is done through hype, and people find it refreshing to interact with someone who's being as real as they possibly can and who has a genuine concern about supporting that potential customer and getting their needs met. And when you show up with that attitude, then you already reduce a lot of the barriers that people might have to hearing what you have to say. And then when you show up really fully immersed in your passions and seeking to understand what the passions of the customer might be, then you're in the best position possible for beginning to have a conversation where you're speaking the same language. And that's the biggest challenge we have, right? In any relationship, whether it's a selling relationship, a romantic relationship, a relationship we have with people that we work with, it's always about, can we find a way to speak the same language so that we understand one another and can communicate effectively?
Those points are just so spot on about the likability and trustworthiness factors being what makes or breaks customer relationships, right? It's not how well you can spout product information and that sort of thing. You talked about being more aware of how they're taking in and processing information and how the customers are receiving them. This is the how to better speak the customer's language, right? How do salespeople get better at connecting to those moments and attributes, I guess?
In my world, in the work that I do, I've used a psychometric tool and concept to teach this to folks called the Passion Profiler. And we can get into what that is later. But basically, what this particular instrument does is codify the notion of passion, which I deem as the outward expression of the purpose that you carry, right? Your purpose is internal, but the passions that it causes you to exhibit are external and measurable and visible to others. Those particular passions or passion archetypes that people carry influence how they show up. And understanding what your passions are and how they cause you to show up, what strengths they allow you to enjoy, what vulnerabilities they might make you more subject to, is really important information to have about yourself. And having at least a basic understanding of all of the different passion archetypes, and there are 10 of them, so that you can start to perceive passion-based behaviors in your customer and begin to sort of ascertain what might this person's archetypes be, and then what's the language I need to speak to them if I want them to hear me.
That gets to the next thing I did want to ask you about was, because I've seen you written about these things called the archetypes of passion. You said there's 10. I don't know if we have time to go into all 10, but can you give some examples?
I'll quickly go through the 10. The first is creator. That's the archetype of the artist, people who like to take ideas and translate them into artistic and emotionally resonant forms. There's the conceiver. The conceivers are the big out-of-the-box strategists, people who push the boundaries of traditional thought about issues. They're the intellectual acrobats, as I like to call them. Then there are people who are discoverers. Discoverers are truth seekers. They know the answers out there somewhere. If I lift up enough rocks and look under it, I'm going to find those answers. So they tend to show up in roles where they're like investigative reporters or forensics or detectives. They're looking and seeking truth. Then there are processors, people who like data and information, and they like to figure out how is that data and information informing the choices we need to make or the direction we need to take. So they're the analysts. There's the teacher archetype, people who really enjoy sharing knowledge and helping others learn and grow and mentoring others. Then there's the connector archetype. Many people who are in sales really thrive with the connector archetype. Those are individuals who like building relationships. They like figuring out who has a problem over here, who's got the solution over there, how do we bring them together? They tend to make great negotiators as well. Then there are two archetypes that I call archetypes of the heart. Their net export of energy is out to others. That is the altruist archetype. Altruists are very concerned about delivering on the promise of the brand. So if the organization says we stand for X, the altruist is looking to see that we're behaving like we stand for X in the way that we interact and treat customers. The healer cares about the pain and challenge that others might be going through, and they take personal responsibility for helping them navigate that pain and get to a better place. And then finally, the two archetypes whose focus is on applying knowledge or applying information that's necessary to deliver on the decisions made from new knowledge are the transformers and the builders. Transformers are the change agents, enjoy the chaos and craziness of the world and figuring out how do we create a new normal from it. And the builders are all about give me a big, hairy, audacious goal and then get out of my way because I'm going to go make it happen. You see a lot of that in salespeople as well, achieving big goals and overcoming what seem to be difficult obstacles, but not letting those obstacles derail them to getting to their goals.
One of the ones you mentioned was a teacher?
Teacher, yes.
So the people that fall into that category are probably the ones that are most likely to develop into good sales leaders.
They develop into good sales leaders, but there are also some sales people who are sales frontline sales folks who are great because they have a teacher archetype. And when it comes to any kind of product where a consultative selling approach is important, where educating the customer is critical and helping them figure out how do we solve your problem with what we have to offer, and here's how you use our product to your best advantage, that teacher archetype can be really valuable.
No, that makes a lot of sense because teaching falls into that consultative selling category, which is what most customers want.
Kind of the cool thing about this world is that very often salespeople will show up. They know what their top three archetypes are. And we always say that the top three that you score in are the ones that really determine the way you're going to behave and the strengths you're likely to enjoy, the vulnerabilities you'll be more subject to, and the environments that you'll thrive best in. We all have our own archetypes that determine who we are and how we interact with others. When you show up with others that are different from you, part of your challenge, especially if they're your customers, is to figure out who are they? What archetypes are they demonstrating? And that's where becoming very good at listening and observing is critical. In fact, very often I've worked with sales folks and they'll go in and they've got their spiel, right? I've got my thing I'm supposed to do. These are the products in my bag. This is the order I'm going to pull them out in. I'm going to sell this stuff to you. Try that with a conceiver. It's not going to work very well. The conceiver archetype is going to say, wait a second, I've got 18 questions that you haven't even thought of yet. And I want the answers to all of them before I'm going to commit to anything. But you think you're going to walk out of there with the deal. You're not if you go in with that approach with a conceiver. If you're a processor and you've got reams of data to prove why your product is the best product on the market compared to everybody else's, and you're going to go deliver that message to a client who's a builder, their eyes are going to glaze over in the first 30 seconds that you're talking because that's not what they're interested in. Put that in the addendum. Tell me how you're going to solve the problem I have today. How are you going to help me make money? Give me some answers that are going to address the biggest issues that are keeping me up at night. Then you have my attention. And speak in bullet points, please. Don't give me paragraphs.
Yes. Those abilities to listen and observe are such understated but critical aspects of being a good salesperson. Like you said, if all you're doing is going in with your product pitch and you can't connect with people on that level, we talk a lot with clients around understanding their behavior styles. So, you know, understanding the way they prefer to communicate and take in and process information and being able to adapt your style to them, very similar to, I think, to what you're talking about. When you're saying figuring out your top three archetypes and understanding how to get those to show up in the room, that's where authenticity becomes important, right? Because that's not something you can fake. If you want to be seen as those three things, you've got to figure out the specific behaviors and do it in a really genuine way. Otherwise, again, the customer's going to figure it out if you're faking it or being disingenuous, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they will. And I think what you have to do more than anything else is own them, embody them. And when you own them and embody them, it's like you get this information about yourself, and then you look for situations in your past where those particular passions have shown up for you. And most people, when they really start to understand their passions, can trace them back to childhood. These show up very early in our lives, and they stay with us throughout our lifetime. The position that your passions have within your top three could shift. What was number three could become number two, and what was number one could be number three over your lifetime. But basically, we tend to carry our same passions throughout our lifetime. So spending time, once you understand this language around what your passions are, spending time thinking about, when have I felt most alive in the work that I've done or in the experiences that I've had? And then asking, what were the passions that were really driving that feeling for me? And then also understanding, when have I shown the strengths associated with these passions? What was the situation where that showed up for me? Or when have I experienced a vulnerability associated with my passion? What was the situation that triggered that vulnerability for me? The more of that internal work you do, the more easily you show up authentically, because you're not thinking about, oh my gosh, am I a builder today? Am I showing up that way? Or am I showing up as a processor today? You are showing up with a degree of competence around your passions that's unconscious. You're not thinking about having to step in the shoes of being archetype one versus archetype two. You're just embodying them all quite naturally. And that's what is attractive. That's what makes people feel like, I'm getting what I see here. This is not somebody pretending to be something that they're not. And that makes the person that you're engaged in that discussion with feel a level of comfort, and I might even say safety, in the interaction that they're having.
What you're talking about requires a degree of being reflective and bringing reflective practice into your job role, right? And your success, it makes a big difference if they create time for it. We did another episode recently when we talked about bringing mindfulness into sales. How do you develop the habit and carve out the time for this? Because it really does require a lot of sort of continuous thinking and reflection, doesn't it?
It does. Oh gosh, there's so much I could say about reflection. One of the things I can tell you is that we've actually done the research on this. And when I was in the process of developing the Passion Profiler assessment, one of the things I noticed is that some people had a disconnect between their passions and how they operated every day in the work environment. The ones who were best at reconciling that difference, in other words, bringing them closer together, were people who were reflective. The ones who struggled were people who were not. So we ended up building into the instrument a set of questions that allowed us to evaluate the degree to which a person had a propensity to reflect. And we divided reflection into two different categories. One we called reflective contemplation. The other we called work-inspired reflection. Reflective contemplation is an evaluation of the degree to which you tend to be a reflective individual in your personal life. So it's the kind of reflection that allows you to decide what your values are, what your convictions are, what role you play in the relationships you share with other people. What stuff do they own about how that relationship is going? What stuff do you have to own? And all the different experiences you have in your personal life help to shape who you are. So the reflective contemplation is really a measure of the degree to which you're using those experiences, kind of round out who you are, inform who you are, shape who you are as a person. Then work-inspired reflection is really exactly what it sounds like. It's a measure of the degree to which work inspires you to think and reflect in a contemplative manner and learn about yourself through your work experiences. Because think about it. We spend a lot of time at work. We talked about that as 85,000 hours. It's the best testing ground for who we think we are, because we spend time there and we're interacting with people that we might not necessarily choose as friends, but we have to interact with them on a daily basis. So what we did find through empirical studies is that people who were highly reflective tended to also be reflective about their work. And people who were reflective about their work also tended to enjoy higher levels of engagement with their work. And that was an important finding, because people were worried about, how do you keep folks engaged at work? I say to lean into reflection, right? Because as work-inspired reflection rises, so does engagement. But the reverse is true. When you stop reflecting, your engagement level drops. So it's an absolutely critical thing to practice based on the data that we have. Now, You ask the question, how do you do that when you have so many other things to do? You make it a priority because you value the output that engaging in that activity is going to afford you. Why do people get up and take cold showers? Because they think that's going to charge them up and make them better at what they're doing every day. Or why do you get up and work out? Or why do people read certain books over and over again? Because they think there's value in that. If you value reflection, then you build time into your day for it. And it, the cool part about it is you don't have to spend a lot of time. It's not like you have to go to some ashram somewhere and take off 6 months of your life to go reconnect with yourself. I tell my clients often, especially around work-inspired reflection, I tell them once a week, you're going to reflect on what you learned about yourself through your work experience. Pick a day of the week you're going to do it. I suggest Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock when things start to ratchet down for the weekend. And one of the most important aspects of that practice is to get yourself out of your normal environment. And I'm a big fan of going outside, being outside in nature. Go take a walk for 20 minutes, come back to your workspace. Get yourself a journal. This is old school, but it works. And there's brain science behind it. Get yourself a journal and jot down in that journal every Friday, what are three things I learned about myself through my work experience this week? Three things, bullet points. I have a builder archetype, you might notice. So builders love bullet points and not paragraphs. So three bullet points about what you learned about yourself. To step back from those, look at them and say, okay, how does this inform how I want to show up next week? And if you keep doing that, science will say, or psychology will say, that after 20 times of doing something, you've now developed a habit, that we don't actually break habits, we just form new ones. So consistency with doing it for a period of time that allows that to become a habit that you value is really the trick.
I like the idea of physically handwriting it down. I think about a colleague of mine who was on our podcast at the beginning of the year. It was around goal setting. And he talked about how there's data around people that write down their goals are far more likely to reach them and stick with them.
It's like creating a dream board. You know, you look up on the dream board at the end of the year and, oh my gosh, I've done all these things. I wasn't even paying attention, but they've happened. They've manifested for me. But writing stuff down is actually anchored in brain science, which says that when we write things down versus typing them into our computers or some sort of an electronic format, the physical act of writing them actually touches different memory and recall centers in our brain and allows us to make use of the things that we've written and recollect them and keep them top of mind for us so that we put them into practice.
That's really good advice. How do salespeople reconcile gaps between their purpose and passions and the realities of some of their daily responsibilities and the reality of their company goals that they need to achieve? Because sometimes there can be a big gap between those, right?
I agree with that. But I also feel that when you have an opportunity to use at least one of your passions in the work that you do, there's such a charge from that. There's such a level of fulfillment that you receive from that, that it makes the other stuff that you have to do actually more bearable. I mean, when I think about myself and I think about the work that I do, there are things that I have to do in running a company like this that are not particularly exciting to me. There's making sure the tax returns are filed on time and looking at company financial reports and all of that sort of thing that's important to do. It's not in alignment with my passions by any stretch of the imagination, but there's so much I get to do in this work that is aligned with my passions that I can carve out space in my brain and in my psyche to do those things that are important to keep the business running because I look at them as opportunities that I'm creating for me to bring more of who I am to the other aspects of the work that we do.
Sometimes they can be the means to an end.
Exactly. And I think that where we struggle a lot of times is that we get so tangled up in this report is due on X date this month, and then I've got to report on this, and I've got to achieve that, that we forget to have fun being who we are in the work that we're doing, looking for at least one place in what you do on a daily basis where you can fully embody being you and contribute to the work and to the organization and to the customer in that way allows you to have a lot more energy for the things that aren't as exciting to you.
Let's talk about what you call the performance triad. It's a really interesting concept that I read a bit about that I'd love you to share. You talk about it as one of those ways of creating more moments where you bring your whole self forward. Can you talk about that?
The performance triad is really my model for the things that we need to pay attention to be our whole selves and to experience the best performance that we can deliver by being our whole selves. And it really consists of three very simple things. Think of it as a simple Venn diagram, which is exactly how I describe it. It's your skills, your passions, and your values. Those are the three things that somehow have to be in alignment for you in order to deliver your very best, where that those three intersect. Now, I'm going to start with skills first, because when I started this work some years ago talking about passion, I had a demand creation issue because there were people who would talk to me about passion, but it was always behind closed doors. Don't tell anybody I'm telling you about how I feel about this, because companies were hell-bent intent on, we want to get the people with the best skills, and that's what we're going to seek out, and we're going to pay the people that we need that have the very best skills, et cetera. And when you talked about passion, people thought that means you don't think skills are important. Well, contraire, skills are very important and they always will be. But if we were looking at people purely for their skills and hiring them purely for their skills and not the whole of who they are, guess what? We've got a retention problem, because somebody else can come out and pay more money to that person for the particular skill set that they carry. However, the game changes when you start introducing passions and values into the equation. And I know this because I actually studied high-performing, high-potential people, and those that were the most connected to their roles, connected to their organizations, and difficult to recruit away were people who were skilled to do the work that they were doing, clearly, but they were also in an environment that allowed their passions to have an outlet. And because their passions had an outlet, they weren't just good at their job. They were devoted to the work that they were doing. They were excited and fulfilled by what they were doing. They weren't just learning new skills for the sake of learning new skills. They wanted to learn new skills because it helped them be even better at what they're doing and allowed them more playground for their passions to have a role in their daily activities. And then when you added into that equation values, these were individuals who looked hard at the organizations that they were a part of or that they were contemplating joining, or even teams that they were contemplating joining. And they asked the question, will my values be honored in this environment?
And it's such an important issue today, right? That people look so much deeper at than they ever did before. Are my values going to be aligned with the organizations?
There's nothing worse than going into work every day and feeling like you have to compromise your values in order to do your job. That's horrible. I'll tell you, in all the years that I've been doing work with leaders and teams and individuals, I have never seen anything fix a flawed value match. Never. So it's one of the most important questions for us to be able to check that box, that we've looked carefully at that. And it's not just what the company says in its website, but it's what people are actually experiencing on the ground every day. Because culture is a lived experience, right? We can talk about it all we want, but it's a lived experience for folks. So what's the lived experience you'll have if you're part of that team or you're part of that organization is an important question to have an answer to. But at any rate, when those three come together, when the skills and the passions and the values are coming together in a healthy way, where they intersect is the sweet spot. That's the what I call the performance nexus. And that's where you thrive in the work that you do and you deliver your best.
And that alignment of values is, again, something that customers feel. It's part of the brand promise that organizations have, right? This is our mission, vision, values that we have on the wall of our reception area in the office and on our website and all those good things. But how are your people actually bringing those things to life and embodying them every day?
And how are we as your customer experiencing those? If you say that's important to you, this is who you, what you stand for, and this is the purpose statement you're showing up with, how as a customer am I experiencing that in the way you interact with me? Because otherwise it's just lip service. And that makes the client already feel that you're being inauthentic. So it's very hard to build trust when they don't feel that you're showing up as you say you should be as you interact with them.
Because the values alignment is something that customers want too. It's one of the many things that they're doing due diligence about you ahead of time, probably before they even ever talk to you, is what does this company stand for?
What do they stand for? And then how can I prove that what they say they stand for, they are actually going to deliver in the way they interact with me, right? So if I have the choice, if I'm a customer and I can spend money with a company that is in alignment with what it says its values are and treats customers in a way that that mirrors that versus one that's kind of got a spotty record, but they might cost me a little bit less. I'm probably going to go with the guy that might cost me a little bit more, but I'm pretty sure of what I'm getting and how I'm going to be treated and how, you know, when a problem arises, who's going to take responsibility for fixing it for me.
That safety factor that you talked about, right? Which you could also frame as risk mitigation because you feel like you're going to be taken care of and they're going to deliver on what they're promising you.
Yes, because at the end of the day, there'll always be someone out there who says they can offer you a cheaper option, you know, if you're a buying customer. But you have to ask yourself, what am I giving up for that cheaper option? What are they not delivering that another organization might deliver for me? And do I need that? When it comes to things like your value system, that goes to integrity. And for most customers that I know, that's a deal breaker. You either show up with it or don't. It's your ticket to get in the door. And then I want proof that you're going to deliver on it because your past behaviors are the best proof I've got. What have you done for others?
Let's help people that are listening to this envision how they can take action themselves here. When you and I spoke previously, you described for me something you called the passion-linked action plan. Could we go into that a bit?
Yes. I mean, it's a deep piece of work that I invite all of my clients to engage in, whether it's a group of people that are on a team that I'm working with to build a really high-performing team, or whether I'm working with a senior executive. One of the things that I ask people to do once they have their passion profile results, I ask them to do deep work around answering important questions. The first is, what's my value system? And I think it's important for everybody to know the answer to that. And it doesn't need to be 18 double-spaced pages that describe that. I ask people to get really simple with it. Give it to me in 5 words. What are your values? But the important thing in answering that is to be able to also describe what those values look like in action. Because we use lots and lots of words in this world, right? What do they mean to you? When that same word could mean something completely different to you, Will, or to me. But what does that particular set of value words mean to you in terms of what it looks like when it's in action? And those values are not values that just apply to you at work. They should apply across the totality of your life. And it's not easy to pick just 5, right? We get verbose when we start down the path of this exercise. But realistically, you can't remember more than 5, right? If you're lucky, you remember the 5. The next thing I ask them to do is to create a statement of purpose for their lives. Why are you here? Big question. Why are you here? And most people struggle with that because it's not an easy question to answer in a way that's truly meaningful and truly describes the unique thing you are here to accomplish in the world. But your passions give you a real sight line to that. So if you go back to your passions and look at them and realize that they're being birthed from an inner purpose that you have, that gives you a good hint as to what that purpose might be. And by the way, it's not my purpose in life is to be a good person or my purpose in life is to raise great kids. No one has ever told me their purpose in life is to be a lousy human being and to raise monsters. You don't get to put that down. So it's really getting deep about that. And it's a sentence or two. It's not lengthy. That then sets the person up with the wherewithal, the ammunition that they need to begin to do some careful planning for their lives. And I ask them to identify some objectives that they're going to commit to achieving in the short run. I don't want a 10-year plan. I want, what are you going to do over the next few months? That are professional objectives. The caveat is that those objectives have to be linked to their purpose, their passions, and their values. Will there be other objectives you have that you're assigned by your boss to do? Yes. They may not necessarily be aligned with who you are. I'm interested in you listing objectives that are, so that when you're engaged in that work, you know you're doing you. And getting very specific about how you're going to achieve it, who's going to hold you accountable, and what success looks like is really critical. The more specific and granular you get around this, the better. And then they're challenged to do the same exercise in their personal lives, which many people tell me is more difficult than doing it in their professional lives. Professionally, we're used to writing objectives down and working to achieve them. Personally, not so much. So for some people, that can be a more difficult exercise, but again, linked to your purpose, your passions, and your values.
Which can also then help sustain you or keep that motivation when you're doing some of those more mundane aspects of our jobs. They're inevitable for all of us that we just have to go through the motions with. But if you realize that they're still in service of these broader objectives in some way, shape, or form, those can help sustain you, right?
I think they can. And I think what it helps us to do is keep ourselves on task. Because if you've written this down and you've committed to this plan and you've got people who are accountability partners for you as you do this work, having the practice of going back and actually looking at what you've written and asking yourself, have I done any of this week? And how am I going to plan to get more of this done or make more progress on this goal that I set for myself next week becomes important, because it should be a living document. It's not something that you just put in your computer, like pictures that we have from 5 years ago from vacation that we never printed off or did anything with, right? It's meant to be real. Having the plan is the first step to actually executing it. It's not up here anymore. It's actually something that you've committed to on paper, and you've committed to someone else around that plan. That makes you start to own it.
And that thing we talked about earlier about carving out time on a Friday afternoon and journaling some of the reflections, that sort of thing.
Yes. I think, you know, what gets scheduled gets done. So actually putting it on your calendar and making sure that you've carved out time for it makes a big difference and increases the likelihood that you'll actually commit to that. I often ask people, do you have a middle name? And most of them will say, yes, no, it's Joe or it's Jessica or whatever their middle name happens to be. And I will ask them, is your calendar a shared calendar among your team? Can other people see what's on it? Invariably, they'll say yes. And so I'll say every Friday at 3 o'clock, you're going to make an appointment with whatever your middle name is. So it'll appear to somebody else that you're busy and that time is scheduled and they can't bump Sam off the calendar or Jessica off the calendar because you've got this meeting with Jessica. Pretty soon they're going to start asking, who's this Jessica person we meet every Friday? But that's okay. Have a name that's associated with that time for you. You're meeting with yourself.
Right. But just that scheduling, it provides that additional layer of accountability that like, oh, I'll get to it tomorrow or next week. How can sales managers better understand how to leverage the passions and competencies of their team members? Isn't that what good coaching is ultimately supposed to look like?
It is. But I also believe that if you're leading others, one of your responsibilities is to understand who they are and to help them get clarity around that. In fact, the very best leaders that I know are extremely self-aware people and constantly interested in learning more about themselves or are developing a language that they can use to describe themselves to others more effectively. So if you're leading other salespeople, one of the challenges you have is understanding their passions, right? Who are they? Most of us understand what skill set people bring to the party and what experiences they bring to the party because they come with a resume, right? I don't want to know the stuff that I can read on the resume. I get that. It's the more intangible stuff that tells me who you are and how you're likely to show up and ways that you can contribute if I'm smart about asking you to do that, what I need to know about as your leader. And I want to know that, you know what? Adam would really be great at this assignment because he has passion X and this assignment is all about using that particular passion. Let me give this assignment to Adam because he's going to thrive in it.
And it's that understanding, because it's different for everybody, right? So you've got to meet people where they are, right?
We absolutely have to, and not think of it as a one size fits all. And, you know, and that's a challenge of being a leader these days. It's not for the faint-hearted. We don't live in a world anymore where I'm the boss, I give you orders, you follow them, and we're going to expect to keep good people for very long, right? People are looking for much more than that, from their relationship with their boss and from their relationship with the organization that they're a part of. And most of the good people I know are looking to be part of organizations and work for people who are interested in helping them grow and learn. And if they start to feel like life's getting stagnant, you're probably going to lose them.
Yeah, it's not about dictating to them what's a priority and what's important to them. It's helping them bring to the surface what's important to them and helping them apply it in their roles.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a military environment where we must take orders based on rank. I was just at a meeting last week speaking to a group of military women who are about to transition out of the military into civilian roles. And that's one big shift. They're used to working in a hierarchical structure, where orders are given, a mission is outlined, and you step into the role that you need to step into to accomplish that particular mission, which is great. I mean, it works in a lot of arenas, but it doesn't work in the general world of work that we're operating in, and certainly not with the generations of thought that exist within our work environment. So, you know, seeking to understand your people, I think, is one of the most critical jobs a leader has. And then making sure that what you ask them to do aligns with who they are, you're probably going to get the best results.
And you have to have that passion for that as a leader. Otherwise, you shouldn't be in the leadership role, right?
No, you shouldn't. If that's not what you want to do, if you don't get excited about the idea of growing talent, and if you're not committed to trying to help people become better than you are, then you probably don't need to be in that role. Because what's going to happen is you may be very successful based on you, right? Because what you can deliver and what you can contribute as an individual person. But will the organization carry forward when you're not there anymore? Will it thrive? And we've seen lots of examples over the last 30 years of organizations that had certain leaders who were phenomenal. And then the moment they retire or go on to some other place, whatever they put in place to help the organization be successful gets dismantled about 2 weeks later.
Thank you for listening, and I really hope you've enjoyed this episode of Mental Selling. Please make sure that you're subscribed, and as always, leave us a comment or a rating. Share it with your networks. You'll get more content like this on our website at integritysolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Will Milano with Integrity Solutions. Thanks very much again for being with us.